Welcome to Open Line with Fred Anderle from WOSU Public Media, an intelligent and balanced discussion on a wide variety of topics.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Lindblad Expeditions, exploring nature's wild, unspoiled places aboard its ships in partnership with National Geographic. Details at 1-800-EXPEDITION.
Just meals in school cafeterias across the country. They want to start a movement for better school food, and they want to help you persuade your school to offer healthful meals if that's necessary with your particular school. Joining us, Amy Califa, journalist and documentary filmmaker who has produced specials on health issues for public television. Welcome to Columbus.
Good morning, Fred. Thank you.
Susan Rubin, director of A Better Way Holistic Health. It's a private health counseling practice in Mount Kisco, New York. She created the Westchester Coalition for Better School Food. Susan, good to have you here as well.
Hi, thanks.
I want to say their documentary film is called Two Angry Moms, and it asks the question, what happens when two fed-up moms try to change school food? The film is going to be shown tonight in Columbus as part of the Wellness Forum's Fall Health Education Conference, Two Angry Moms, the movie, free and open to the public, 7 o'clock this evening at the Thomas Worthington High School. I think many of you know where that is, at 300 West Dublin Granville Road. Well, tell me, what does happen when two fed-up moms try to change school food? What's the story here?
Well, the story is that I was fed up. I was feeding my kids, you know, sending them with a healthy packed lunch. And I learned that when they would go to school, what we were sending was really being undermined by the food environment at the school. The kids were buying chips and Pop-Tarts and Rice Krispie treats and all kinds of other things that I just really didn't want my kids, having available to my kids on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So I got sick of being the lone voice in the minority, and I felt that this really should be a mainstream issue, and I really believed that there were other parents who felt like I did, and I wanted to find a way to learn what we could do to get better food in school. So I set out on a quest, and I was eventually led to Dr. Rubin, who had been working in her school system for 12 years trying to make a change, and things were starting to happen there. So I decided to follow them over the course of a school year in one particular community in Susan's County in Westchester, and we really saw a change happen.
Susan, tell me about that school system and that change.
Well, it's actually not the school district where I live. My journey started about 12 years ago when my oldest daughter came home from school with candy in her backpack. I was a dentist at the time, and I was completely appalled. I since left dentistry, and now I'm a holistic nutritionist. So I formed an outside coalition called Better School Food. And basically what we did was we created a event for key school decision makers throughout the county. And from this particular school, Katona Lewisboro, the board members and the superintendent, they said, you know what? This has got to be done. Meanwhile, my school district, who was also there, board members and the superintendent, they came up to me and they said, this can't be done.
Can't
so
be done. Okay.
If you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
Mm-hmm. When is it, this can't be? What is this?
Changing the food, overhauling, auditing the ingredients in the cafeteria, looking at the policies. Are your teachers giving candy rewards to students?
Mm-hmm.
Are you using tubs of cookie dough as fundraisers? So there are many components to the toxic food environment in schools.
So it's even the possibility of a teacher unknowingly handing candy to the kids as a reward for a particular assignment, huh?
Yeah, exactly. And I think in our culture, food is not used as part of our education system. It's this, you know, kind of 20-minute break in the day where kids have a free-for-all and they call it lunch. My husband is from France, and I've had the opportunity to see how school food operates there. And it's really integrated not only into the lunch period but into the curriculum, where kids learn about gardening, they learn about growing food, they learn about preparing food. They learn the story and the history of their culture through food. And it really changes the entire way that they eat. And children will eat healthy whole foods if they're given that if they're given the opportunity to learn about them in this kind of integrative way.
I wonder if we had just have, to a certain extent, a junk food culture. In other words, if a teacher gives candy to a kid, well, that may be what the teacher is giving his or her children at home, and we just all accept this.
We really, I think those teachers mean well,
yes.
But I think we've all become just kind of numb and dumbed down to what we're doing around food. We're really pretty mindless. We eat mindlessly. We eat really empty, non-nourishing things, food products, not necessarily food.
And the impact, you know, is going to be felt really strongly and really soon. I mean, you know, the money that we're saving on food by feeding kids cheap, junky food is already being felt in the healthcare system, and that's just going to get worse and worse. This is the first generation in the nation's history that's predicted to live shorter lives than those of their parents. And this is a terrible crisis.
We've got an obesity epidemic among kids, right? And diabetes epidemic. We've got ADD proliferating, anxiety, right, as well?
Yeah.
And do you connect all of these with diet?
Absolutely. Don't forget asthma, allergies, behavioral issues. All of these are connected to the quality of the food that we're putting in our bodies.
When a school has a menu in its cafeteria and practices in the classroom that are not the best, shall we say, nutritionally, what are some of the kinds of things you see? What do you see the kids eating in the cafeteria?
It's really what you see kids eating in society at large. I mean, what's happened is that fast food and junk food has penetrated our schools. And, you know, it's a question of economics. The school food programs often have a mandate to at least break even. And they, you know, so the food has to be cheap. And what's cheaper than fast food? Nobody's really looking at the quality of the food. And that's really what we're trying to do, is get parents to go into the schools to start just asking questions and learning not just what's the menu, because most school menus are fairly identical, really. Mm-hmm. But what is in the food that the kids are eating, and start to read ingredients and try to find better substitutes for some of the items that are there. It's, you know, it's not about so much the names of, you know, whether it's chicken or this or that. But, you know, when you start to look at what's in a, you know, a chicken nugget, well, you could have a whole piece of chicken. The kids are going to like it just as well, but it's going to be much healthier.
You could have chicken on the menu and it could be a perfectly good meal. You know, roasted chicken, some broccoli, maybe, potato. Or on the other hand, as you say, you could have the chicken nugget. So you've got to look beyond what the menu says. Huh?
Yes, exactly. You know.
And so when kids lined up in your documentary, Amy, when you photographed them at the lines, when they had what you think of as bad stuff, I mean, was it hot dogs? Was it fast food hamburgers? Was it chocolate milk? What did they...
You know, what happens a lot, too, in school cafeterias is it's not just about what they are eating. It's also about what they aren't eating and the time that they're getting to eat. So it's not so much, I mean, it, of course, it is what's available in the cafeteria. But then if the child only has 10 minutes for lunch, a lot of them will grab that giant cookie and grab that, you know, flavored water. And that's called lunch. And this, you know, so they're not getting the nutrients that they really need to sustain them throughout the day.
We're talking about making school lunches nutritionally better. Amy Califa, journalist, documentary filmmaker. You've seen some of her specials on health issues for public television. Dr. Susan Rubin, director of A Better Way Holistic Health, a private health counseling practice in Mount Kisco, New York. We're at 614-292-8513. Let me tell you, their documentary film, Two Angry Moms, asks the question, what happens when two fed-up moms try to change school food? You can see the film tonight in Columbus as part of the Wellness Forum's Fall Health Education Conference. It's free and open to the public. Thomas Worthington High School at 300 West Dublin Granville Road at 7 o'clock this evening. So, but you also have examples in the film, and I've seen some. We have a website, Two Angry Moms, and I've seen some of the examples that people have done some wonderful things with their school lunch programs. Tell us about some of them, Susan.
Well, one of the things is that we are not out to completely bash school lunch. The movie really does show some wonderful, inspiring programs throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And there are garden programs that are integrated with the curriculum. There are amazing food service directors who have done wonderful things to really create a healthier bottom line.
Yeah, on a limited budget. So this can be done. I mean, it does take a lot of ingenuity right now, but that's another reason I made the film. I wanted to show models that were already in place so that every school district doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. And, you know, there's information out there if people want to.
Because I imagine some school districts may think, we can't afford to do this. If we really serve all this wonderful, healthy, nutritious food, our costs are going to go through the roof, mm-hmm. and we're not going to be able to afford to do it. But mm-hmm. the examples you have in the movie show us that's really not true.
It can be cost effective. We can't afford not to do it is really the answer to that. And yes, you know, better food does cost more, but it's pay now or pay later. And mm-hmm. and really, it's a net savings if we put a little bit more into what we're feeding our children now, we're going to save hugely. And they're going to be better, more functioning members of society as they grow up.
Before we go to our callers, tell me about some of the things you found in terms of really chefs and school systems providing quality meals. You have the Yale Sustainable Garden as one example, but growing their own food. Tell me about that.
That's just a wonderful program. And it's really what I consider to be a laboratory because they're sourcing their food locally. And they've got one of their dining halls where all of the food is locally sourced. A lot of it is organic, which means it has more nutrients in it. And the students love this food so much. I mean, they weren't sure when they started this how it was going to go over, that their students from the other dorms are faking IDs to get into this one dining
hall.
This
is Yale University.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So they've had to increase the program throughout the other colleges in the university because mm-hmm. there was such a demand for it.
How about some secondary school and primary school systems? Some other things did you find?
Well, there are some wonderful examples in private schools because it is, you know, it's easier to make change in a private school where
sure.
you have more control over that. But then it's beginning to take place in public schools now. One of the great examples is in Berkeley, California, which is a large school district. Over 50% of the children in that district are on free or reduced meal program. So it's not, you know, a wealthy district. And it's a really good example where they voted as a district to allocate a little bit more funding to the lunch program, just like you do when mm-hmm. you allocate funding to a new ball field or to textbooks or whatever else you consider essential to education. And that's what they've done there. And as a result, they've got just an amazing food program. And it's really integrated into the curriculum. One of the things I love there is they have all their kids wash their hands before they eat lunch.
Good idea.
Very simple, well, very effective.
Well, Chef Ann Cooper in Berkeley is in your film. She's militant about this. She says she serves 4,200 high-quality meals a day, and you can do this.
That's right.
Can be done.
If you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
Okay, let's go to our callers, 614-292-8513. Joy is on the line. Hi, Joy.
Hi. First of all, I just want to commend your guests today for the work that they're doing. I think it's wonderful and very important. And secondly, I think one of the biggest problems is parents and the majority of the population don't understand the problems with the foods that they're purchasing and they're giving their children, foods that have partially hydrogenated oils in them or high fructose corn syrup in them. And I was a member of a parent-teacher organization at a local school, public school here, and volunteered in the lunchroom one day and just watched what the kids, you know, what kind of choices they made to select for their lunch. And they would get the big cookie and the red drink, and that would be lunch.
Oh, my.
And I presented this issue to the PTO that said kids at this age, they can't make good choices for themselves. And the head of the school said, well, you know, and I said, most parents, if there is a plate of donuts in front of you or a basket of fresh fruit, a lot of people, you know, are going to pick the donut,
sure.
you know, just because that's what they like. But if there are no donuts available and there's only fresh fruit and the kids are hungry, they might eat the fruit.
Surely. So let's get comments here from Dr. Susan.
Well, you know, you are just the kind of person that we need. Because as a mom, as a parent, our bottom line is the health and well-being of our kids. And so we really need people like you. My organization, Better School Food, is set up specifically to support parents who are working to advocate for less hydrogenated oils and high fructose corn syrup. For members, we actually have sheets, downloadable information sheets, so that you can help to educate your community. And you're right. Some parents we need to raise the food IQ in a number of parents. And it's people like you that can really help to do that. So I want to encourage you to get involved even more than you are already.
If somebody wanted to get involved in their local community, how would they do that?
There's a number of ways they can get involved. You know, one of the reasons I made the film is because there's a quote from the Texas Secretary of Agriculture, Susan Combs, who said, It's going to take 2 million angry moms to change school food. Susan and I are the first two. But, you know, we're trying to reach that 2 million point, and that will be a tipping point on our website, which, by the way, it's angrymoms.org.
Angrymoms.org.
If you sign up, it's a free monthly newsletter. It, you know, again, it's a way to organize all the parents and create that tipping point. Bring the film to your community. Show it. That's a first step. Better School Food, Susan's organization, has a lot of help and advice that, you know, that parents can have so that they don't feel that they're alone in this fight.
Okay. Back to our callers here. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Fred. I wanted to ask your guests if in their research across the country, if they have ever come across any sort of, where the menus are being, or pork is being taken out of the menus in schools.
Why would that be happening?
Well, I mean, the reason why I'm asking is because in Columbus Public Schools, in the elementary schools, they have a one choice plan, and it's all made from a central location, mm-hmm. and there's no pork in any of those menus, I've never gotten a good reason why.
Amy, Susan, I don't know what we can say about that. Anything you've run across?
I would say the same thing to any concerned parent, is that you have to go to your food service director, go to your administration, ask to see the list of items that are available for the food service, and then, really help be part of that. There's wellness committees now that you can mm-hmm. sit on and help make the determination of what is going to be served in the cafeteria.
Thank you, Larry. We're at 614-292-8513 for just a couple of more minutes here with Amy Califa and Dr. Susan Rubin. And Sarah is next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I was actually just tuning in, and my question is, how are we blaming or placing blame in some place based on one meal a day? And I do know that, you know, some children eat breakfast at school and then they're also having lunch. Mm-hmm. But for one meal a day, and I don't know. I mean, I'm sure children are not eating the big cookie and the red pop at home for dinner. So I guess I'm wondering how we...
Sure.
figure that out.
Sure. Sarah, hang on the line. Dr. Susan, you'd like
to. It's a really simple equation. It's one meal a day, yes, but it's 180 days a year, 12 or 13 years. It does add up. It does. This is their formative years where kids are making their food choices and really making decisions that will affect them the rest of their lives as far as their tastes and what they're going to choose. So it really does make a difference. It may seem tiny at the time, but it's not just one meal. It's 180 days a year, 12 years.
Sarah, what do you think?
I'm not sure I agree.
Okay, good.
Just because, I don't know, I'm 35. I went to Columbus Public Schools. I maybe didn't make the healthiest choices in my high school years where I had some latitude in my own lunches. But then after, you know, graduating from high school and going on to college, and now I'm an adult, I have my own family, I'm not still eating that same way. And I believe that the reason is because I had healthy meals at home. Now, I did eat fast food. I did go for the cookie. I ate chocolate milk in high school. But, I mean, certainly I didn't continue on that same road once I was out of that environment.
Okay.
So I guess, I don't know. I'm not sure that it's that simple.
Okay, Amy, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I agree with you, Sarah. It's not that simple. And I just, you know, one of the things that I've observed is that school food seems to be a reflection of the larger food culture in our society. And, you know, for people like you and maybe me, we were lucky about our outside influences. Not all children have that at home to model. And I just strongly feel that school is an educational environment. And, you know, the same way that we don't have harmful things in our schools in terms of, yes, it's legal to smoke cigarettes when you're 16, but it doesn't mean we should put a cigarette machine in the high school cafeteria. I would just like to have, you know, better choices for the kids, and also a system that educates them about those choices and really celebrates food rather than you know, looks at it as a necessary evil, which I think mm-hmm. our schools do at this point.
Sarah, thanks for your call. Of course, there's some business considerations here, right? We have soft drink companies who get pouring rights with a particular school in terms of providing the school with money and other things. We have fast food manufacturers who provide learning materials for the classroom. You know, let's say a fast food company says, look, I'm going to give you this little history comic book, and guess what? It shows you how to buy our fast food burger. So there's some financial aspects here too, huh?
Yeah, there's a huge marketing piece, and our kids are being marketed to all of the time. And part of what that does is it really undermines parental authority. So we really have to kind of take a look at that. But as far as the pouring contracts, it's really a tax on the community. If you think about it, that's the money. That's where the money is going into those machines from the community. Mm-hmm. So it's raising money for the school, but not as much as you might think.
Right. Marion Nessel, who's one of the experts in the film, did a study on it, and it came out to about $20 per kid that the school was profiting on those vending machines per year. And like Susan said, it's coming directly out of the children's pockets. So why not just ask the parents to, you know, spend $20 more on a healthy lunch?
Okay. Let's go. A couple of more minutes left here. Ed, we have time for you. Hi.
Hi, Fred. How's it going?
Good.
A quick couple of points on two of your callers. The gentleman that called about no pork in some schools, I think that's probably for religious reasons. There, Jewish folks, Orthodox Jews, keep kosher, don't eat pork. And the other point I wanted to make is that, and some Muslims don't either. The other point I wanted to make, the lady said that well, the child wouldn't get the red pop and the big cookie at home. I would suggest don't be too sure, because a lot of times kids don't have any better choices at home than they do in school.
Okay, Ed, thanks. Thanks for your comments. I imagine that's true in some cases, huh? Want to mention one other? Oh, let us go to this caller here. Caller, if you're quick, we've got time for you. Hi.
Okay, very quickly. I didn't hear the whole program, but I had seen a DVD called Bad Seed, The Truth About Our Food, and it was concerning GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and I would suggest that maybe your guests could look also into that, how it affects our bodies and also the earth. It's very important, I think. So that was my only little comment.
Okay. Let's comments from Amy and Susan.
We agree. Genetically modified foods are downright scary.
And not tested. So until, you know, I'm very excited because the president of France just banned them in his country. And his comment was, until we know more, until, you know, these foods have been really scientifically tested, we'd rather err on the side of caution. And I wish we could do that in this country, especially with our children.
By the way, before we close, one more example from the film Two Angry Moms. A fellow with an interesting guy. The school food service director in Riverside, California, Rodney Taylor, was very interesting because he said some parents came to him about better foods. And at first he thought, oh, this is just upper middle class parents with too much time on their hands, he says. But they convinced him. And now, let us know, he's buying from a local farmer's market, and they go and select the foods, and they do this.
They do this, and the kids are loving it. It's a really successful program. And what they're finding is that the staff is buying the salad bar also. So economically, it's working out in his favor. It's a great program, mm-hmm. and it needs to be expanded.
So in the final minute, first steps for somebody who's how do you find out what your school is serving? Do you simply go to the school and say, hi, I want to observe your cafeteria?
On the angrymoms.org website, we actually have a lunch-in checklist, and you can go have lunch in the cafeteria at your school, and we've got a nice little checklist and also a humorous tongue-in-cheek article about searching for food in the school cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is something that's doable for those who would like to see it done.
Absolutely.
And you may be delighted to find that your local school has wonderful meals, but maybe you won't be.
But okay. Find out.
Yeah. Want to mention the film, the documentary film, Two Angry Moms, is going to be shown tonight from the Wellness Forum, and here's the location. Free and open to the public, 7 o'clock tonight at the Thomas Worthington High School, 300 West Dublin Granville Road. If you'd like more information about the film or the Wellness Forum, call 841-7700. That's 841-7700. Amy Califa, Susan Rubin, thanks very much for being with us this half hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And when we come back, geneticist Francis Collins says it's very reasonable to have faith in God. And we'll talk with him right after these messages at WOSU 820. You're all day NPR News. Station.
next time on Day to Day.
In 1980, Alan Tannenbaum shot some intimate photographs of John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
The couple hadn't seen them printed yet.
I was in the darkroom making prints, and the editor of the paper came in and said, John Lennon's been shot.
Unseen moments with pop music's most famous couple.
I really think that it does come through how much love there was between them.
Next time on Day to Day.
I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round.
That's Day to Day coming up at noon in just about 30 minutes right here on WOSU 820. And coming up later today on Marketplace, Marketplace kicks off the Consumed series. It takes a look at how much the average American family consumes. That story and all the day's business headlines tonight at 6 o'clock on Marketplace right here on WOSU 820. And taking a quick look at your forecast, a cloudy day today with a chance of rain throughout the day, a high of 55. For tonight, clear skies overnight with a low of 35. And looks like a beautiful weekend ahead, Saturday partly sunny with a high of 52. And Sunday, sunshine in the morning with a high of 52. There's a slight chance of rain on Sunday. Currently, it's 48 degrees at 11:31. And now, we'll take you back to Open Line with Fred Anderle.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, a leading scientist talks about his belief in God. Geneticist Francis Collins was first an agnostic, then an atheist, then a believer. He says that his journey to believing in God ultimately seemed more rational than disbelief, more rational. But he says the tools of science were not the right ones for him to learn about God, because God, he says, is outside the natural world. He says that the evidence of God's existence for him would have to come from other directions, and his decision to believe would be based on faith, not proof. We'll find out more. Francis Collins, one of the world's leading geneticists and the longtime head of the Human Genome Project, which identified all of the approximately 20 to 25,000 genes in human DNA, and he helped discover the genetic misspellings that cause cystic fibrosis, neurofibromatosis, and Huntington's disease. My guest's current book is The Language of God: A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief, and my guest will be with us next Wednesday, November 14th, for a special program at WOSU at COSI. We'll find out more about that as we welcome back to Open Line Francis Collins. Good to have you back, Francis.
It's wonderful to be with you, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Francis, you said that faith is a very reasonable choice, that faith can be approached rationally, that faith and reason go hand in hand. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, I think that has been the perspective of many serious believers down through the centuries, but perhaps in the current spate of angry pronouncements coming from extremists on this spectrum of science and religion, we've lost the idea that, in fact, faith can be an entirely rational choice. In fact, from my perspective, it is the most rational choice. For anyone to say with supreme confidence that there can be no God, if you think about it, must certainly be getting outside of the boundaries of a statement that anyone could make with certainty, unless they're really afflicted with a great deal of arrogance, because, as Chesterton once said, the statement of a universal negative is perhaps the most daring of all dogmas. And certainly, if all of us have to admit that our knowledge of the universe and what exists and what does not exist is limited, the idea of being able to say we can exclude God's presence doesn't seem like an intellectually defensible position. Mm-hmm. It was that kind of argument that caught me up short as an atheist in my mid-20s studying quantum mechanics, and made me realize that perhaps there was something more to consider here as far as an intellectual basis for deciding about whether or not a belief in God was something I wanted to embrace. And that was a surprise to me. I was not raised in a home where faith was considered important, and so it was quickly my decision, because it was kind of convenient not to be responsible to anyone outside myself, that, you know, God was irrelevant and this was all a carryover from past eras. But, you know, I think that's actually not a position that a thinking, mature person can easily defend.
Mm. As you point out, when you were raised, your parents said, if you sing in church, please disregard the sermon. And when you got to grad school, you subjected your atheism to rational analysis, and you say it just didn't hold up. But now tell me about, Francis, the intellectual process in terms of arriving at faith.
Well, actually, the thing that really caught me up short was going to medical school after I got my PhD in physical chemistry and decided I wanted to look more at the life sciences, wanted to have something closer to humanity. And yes, I learned a lot about the human body and the mechanical ways in which it's put together, but I also learned sitting at the bedside of people who were facing terminal illness that there are serious issues about life and death and whether God exists and why we all have this longing to search for the spiritual. And I realized that that is not an area that I had explored and it needed to be. And after wrestling a bit with how to go about that and wondering if there were any such intellectual arguments that could be brought to bear, I was introduced to the writings of the Oxford scholar C.S. Lewis, who was for me a perfect guide in this because Lewis himself, intensely, deeply intellectual person, who had been an atheist, who went about trying to understand why other people believed, assuming that there wouldn't be much there, and ultimately discovered some of these great truths that had been enunciated down through the centuries but weren't available to him and certainly weren't to me until I began to read his descriptions of those arguments. Perhaps the most compelling to me early on was this argument about the moral law, something that is so familiar in everyday existence that I hadn't really thought about it. This notion that we humans have this idea that there is such a thing as good and evil and that we're called to do the right thing. And we see in many instances in our daily experience how people are using the moral law as an argument about why people should behave in a certain way or excusing themselves sometimes for not behaving that way because there was some reason for it. But nobody seems to disagree that there is such a thing as right and wrong and that people are supposed to do the right thing. And where does that come from?
So it's universally held, really, among all, that we know there is a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do. And we may not agree in particular instances. There may be disagreements over a particular case. But nonetheless, it seems almost like a gut-level feeling, doesn't it? It seems in our bones in a way that, yeah, we strive to do right. And when we do wrong, we understand that we're deviating from a path that is instilled in us, the path to doing right. Huh?
Exactly. So where does that come from? It basically, one is left with a couple of possible explanations. The sociobiologists or evolutionary psychologists would argue this is something that has been hardwired into our brains because it's provided some reproductive advantage, and evolution only cares about that, and so that must be the basis. But I can point to instances where that doesn't work at all. Some of the most dramatic, noble actions that humankind has been known to undertake, the actions of an Oscar Schindler risking his life to save thousands of people from the Holocaust, who he does not know and who are not part of his own tribe, if you will, that's a scandal to evolution. Evolution would completely disapprove of that behavior because he was basically putting his own DNA at risk and allowing the DNA of other potential competitors to survive. Makes no sense on an evolutionary basis. And I think actually when you look at the noblest actions of humankind, the thing that we admire the most, they are completely contrary to this rather depressing notion that all of this comes about simply on the basis of evolutionary pressures. And it, speaking of depressing, it carries you to an even more discouraging position if you want to argue that the moral law is solely arisen on the basis of evolutionary pressure, because what that says is that good and evil are actually concepts that we have been hoodwinked about by evolution. They have no real meaning. There is no such thing. We're under delusion that such things actually exist. And even the most strident atheists seem to believe that good and evil are important. And I think in that regard, perhaps they're being inconsistent. So the other alternative, if you can't see a reason for the moral law on a purely biological, evolutionary, mechanical basis, is that there's something else here. And if you were looking for a glimmer of the existence of something that you can't explain on the basis of pure biology, and something that might be calling to us to reach outside of ourselves to God, then wouldn't this be an interesting place to find it, written on our hearts, universal in the human species, pointing towards something wonderful, noble, and holy that we can only barely begin to glimpse, and calling us also to both search for the source of that holiness and to strive ourselves to try to be
better than we otherwise would be.
So, Francis, is this innate knowledge that we all have, this knowledge of right and wrong that we can, as you say, and I say feel, that you can simply, it's in your bones. Was this the principal intellectual underpinning for the faith that you acquired when you moved from atheism to faith, or were there others as well?
There were others. This one got my attention. It's in the first three pages of Lewis's book called New Christianity. It was the first argument I encountered and had difficulty coming up with reasons why he was on the wrong track. And then that required me then to look at what other evidences might be there. Was this one that was easily shot down, or was there a whole tapestry of arguments? Well, there are, and some of them come from science, actually. And even though I had studied physics and chemistry and was aware of the strong evidence that the universe had a beginning in the Big Bang, I had not wrestled with the philosophical implications of that. Nature has not been observed to create itself. And if we say that the entire universe began in this unimaginable flash, this singularity, some 13 billion years ago, then how could that be? And what came before that? You can't really postulate a creative process that was just natural, because then you haven't solved the problem. The only solution I can think is that this was a creative process that was conducted by something or someone who is outside of nature and therefore not subject to those other restrictions, and that sounds like God. And more than that, when you look at the way the universe actually was put together, the fine-tuning, the nature of the constants that determine how matter and energy operate, it is astounding to see the degree of precision that each of those constants has to have in order to make any kind of complexity possible. If the gravitational constant or the speed of light or the strong or weak nuclear forces were tweaked by the tiniest bit, there would be no possibility of coalescence of matter into galaxies and stars and planets and us. It would be this infinitely boring, sterile universe with no potential for creatures capable of love and conversation and spirituality. And you have to look at those particular parameters and marvel that they were set just so. And I think even the strongest atheist has a problem with that argument.
Because these parameters are so delicate, as you point out, and so precise. And if any one of them, a significant one, were out of balance, we wouldn't have what we have now. This universe, in the sense that it exists now, could not exist in the order that it exists.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, a profound observation. Now, again, one has a couple of options here to try to explain that. I don't think one of those is to say, well, it's just a coincidence, because the coincidence in this instance has a probability that is so low as to be almost unimaginable and impossible to state mathematically. You either have to say that there are perhaps an infinite number of parallel universes out there that we'll never be able to observe, that have different values of these constants, and of course we could only exist in the one where they were just right, but that really strains your imagination. Or else you have to say this was intentional, there was a purpose here. Choosing between those two options, I think the latter is more plausible. Mm-hmm. You could also ask, and this is something, oddly, that I never thought about when I worked in chemistry and physics, is why should the universe obey these beautiful, simple mathematical laws? Why should mathematics work? Even the physicist Wigner, who was not particularly one enamored of faith, called this the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. There's no obvious explanation why the universe should be put together in this way. It reflects the idea that there's a mind behind all of this, an amazing mathematical mind. And, of course, for many of us who've studied science, that's not too far away from the view we begin to get of God. Even Einstein had that view of God, although he didn't see God as one interested in personal affairs. He certainly, in his writings, talks about the amazing mind that must have been behind the way the universe behaves when it comes to mathematics that he was able to derive. Things like the theory of relativity seem to have some wonderful, incredibly deep explanation in terms of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Geneticist Francis Collins with us. He's the author of The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. Just for him in a moment, we'll go to you. Call us at 614-292-8513. Francis, you're going to be with us here in Columbus.
I am indeed.
Next Wednesday, November 14th, on a panel which is entitled The Intersection of Faith and Evolution, A Civil Dialogue. And I'll be moderating the panel along with Dr. Collins. There'll be Dr. Jeffrey McKee of the OSU Department of Anthropology, Dr. Patricia Princehouse of Case Western Reserve University, University Department of Philosophy, Dr. David Rupi, a scholar of religion. That's going to be, let me tell you all, you're welcome. It's going to be next Wednesday, November 14th, from 7:30 in the evening until 9 o'clock. The panel discussion is going to be followed by a question and answer session. It's going to be at WOSU at COSI Studios, down at COSI Columbus. Now, all our pre-registration is full. So for the television studio, where it will be, in fact, videotaped, that is full. But we have an anteroom there, an atrium, in which there are seats, and you don't need to pre-register. You just come Wednesday, November 14th, around 7:30 to WOSU at COSI. Also, it's going to be video linked here to the Fawcett Center at 2400 Olentangy River Road and to the Newark and Lima campuses, Science Room 100 at Lima. If you need more information about any of this, 228-2674. Once again, call 228-2674. And then I'm going to give you a four-digit extension on campus here, 2541, 2541. If you need more information, I will repeat those numbers a bit later. Dr. Collins will also deliver a lecture on that same day, Wednesday, November 14th, from at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at 131 Hitchcock Hall. And that will be, again, 4 o'clock, Wednesday, November 14th, free and open to the public, 131 Hitchcock Hall. We're at 614-292-8513. Give you that information again before we close. All of this sponsored by the Department of Entomology, the College of Medicine, the Institute for Collaborative Research, and the OSU Newark Campus, and the Office of the President of The Ohio State University. Okay, we have all that information for you, which will give you the gist of that again. And let us go to our caller, Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just had two things I was interested in presenting. One is I don't see a real problem with the Big Bang argument. If we can see how it works on natural principles before the Big Bang, just because we don't know how it got into the position where it had the Big Bang, what came before, it could be natural principles there too. But on a bigger question, even if one accepts all the arguments that we need to think there's a God, even if you accept that, then you're just floundering around because, you know, which God are you going to believe in and how are you going to justify, you know, I'm going to use this book. I choose on faith to choose this book or this belief or that belief. I don't see how that, even if you believe there's a God, how, if there are 10 religions that claim to be the one true religion, only one of them can be right.
Well, Francis, you're Christian, of course, as you note in your book, The Language of God. And a caller asks, you know, how do you get from these basic principles and basic rational devices to choose a particular religion? That's a good question.
It's a great question, and it reflects the journey I went on from being an atheist to becoming convinced that that was not a rational position, to then beginning to get interested in the possibility of God, to ultimately admitting that belief in God was more plausible than disbelief. But then what kind of God would this be? And I undertook a bit of a search of world religions, trying to understand what they have to say about the nature of God based on centuries of thought and exploration and human experiences. And I realized that a lot of the world religion principles are the same across religions, but of course they do have differences, particularly in the nature of their claims about how it is that one gets to know who God is. And as I searched through those religions, despite the similarities, I did encounter this one really remarkable character, and that was the character of Jesus Christ, who claimed not only to know about God, but to actually be God. And I was astounded to discover that the claims of the New Testament, that the stories of Christ's life, are actually remarkably well documented historically. I had assumed there was a lot of myth involved here, and there certainly are other parts of the Old Testament that have more the flavor of myth than of history. But the New Testament, in many ways, has stood up remarkably well to close scrutiny. And after reading many of those critiques for and against whether, in fact, the claims of Christ should be taken seriously, I felt for me they really had to be. And I felt that call very strongly. And perhaps in a certain way, I sort of felt, I hope that the religion that I decided to settle on as the closest to the truth wouldn't be Christianity, because here in the U.S., everybody would say, well, of course, that's what he would end up because he's surrounded by all these other Christians. But in fact, when I looked at the facts of the matter, I found them very compelling. I will have to say, you cannot prove this. You still do have to come to faith as a matter of a personal decision. And I did so after a couple years of this kind of struggle. But I do think the foundation in terms of the historical evidence for Christianity is remarkably strong, and even atheists have to admit that.
Francis, I would imagine it would make sense to you that someone else who came to faith in God and then proceeded to examine evidence for various religions might conclude that another religion, Islam or Buddhism or Judaism or another religion might be the one that they would follow. That would be a reasonable conclusion.
They might very well. And I think the important part of this conversation is that every person ought to take the time to actually do that exploration. I might well have gone through my whole life without doing so, because it was sort of an area that I hadn't paid much attention to. And it came to my attention because of this experience of talking to people who were close to death and hearing their concerns about their own lives and their confidence they had in their relationship with God. And that made me hungry to find out what they were talking about. So I would just urge everyone to take the time to do that kind of search, and you'll find the truth, I'm confident of it, if you set out to look for it. And no one else can tell you what the answer is.
We're with geneticist Francis Collins for a few more minutes. Sir, callers, be concise now in your questions and keep your statements brief, and we'll get to as many of you as we can. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. Are you there?
Yeah, I just was listening. It was a very good topic today, and I enjoy your speaker. I've always been intrigued a little bit about the Einstein's theory of relativity equals mc squared, and how that may apply to a divinity. And I was wondering if your speaker could say something about that. To me, it means that you can't really describe what God is. If E equals mc squared, it would be impossible for humans to get a handle on a physical understanding of what God is, because God has the capability under that theory of being anything. I've had some people, my mom and my father-in-law close to me recently pass away, and that has been a deeply spiritual event for me. If you ever talk to the hospice workers my mom and my father-in-law went and ask them about their experiences, I think almost to a person, they all believe in some spiritual presence. Mm-hmm. In the world, and that's enough for me.
Okay, Mark, thank you very much. Francis, would you like to comment?
Well, certainly the theory of relativity, which demonstrated the way in which energy and matter can be interconverted, certainly surprised a lot of people who hadn't thought about it quite in those terms. And I, again, think that's a wonderful and marvelous example of the notion that there must be a mind behind the way the universe works. Why should such a simple equation as that apply so precisely to energy and matter? But I don't think it applies to God. I think God, being outside of nature, is the author of those laws, but is not limited by them. There's no reason I can think of why God should be so limited. I appreciate your comment about hospice workers, and again, that resonates with me. I think anybody who has been close to the death and dying process cannot help but be moved by that, cannot help but consider their own mortality, and cannot, therefore, put aside some of the dailiness of all of the busy things that we're doing and contemplate some more serious questions of life and death and God's existence. And I would urge anybody listening to this program to take a moment to ask themselves whether they have conducted that kind of exercise or whether there's something there that needs some more searching.
Thank you, caller. Our next caller here is Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. Good. I guess my question is, about evolution. In the past I've called in and scientists have said that I've asked them, what is a thought? And they tell me, well, a thought is a chemical and an electrical process of your body, and depending on the chemicals, you could be happy, you could be sad. So wouldn't you say that evolution is part of this emotion, because you can alter emotions with certain drugs?
So I would say the fact that emotions have some chemical basis in no way means that they are purely reductionist in our ability to understand them, any more than the fact that when I make a decision that probably has some neurotransmitter consequences means that my free will is an illusion. I think it's very much a reality. And I don't think the idea of love, whether it's romantic love or altruistic love, though you might be able to identify some components of what happens in the brain during that experience, I don't think that limits the possibility that it has a reality to it, any more than, the notes on the page of a wonderful musical piece can convey fully the experience of listening to that music. So I guess I'm a little concerned that many of the efforts in neuroscience right now are being seen as reductionist, as by basically taking who we are as human beings and reducing that to something more mechanical. I don't see that needs to be the conclusion. certainly when it comes to evolution, many people wonder, how can a geneticist who studies DNA also be a believer in God? Isn't that going to cause your brain to explode from the conflict? Well, not at all. I do see the evolutionary process as incredibly well supported by all of the data that we have, some from the fossil record, but more prominently these days from DNA. But if God chose to use that method to carry out creation with the full intention of it resulting in creatures with intelligence who would have this moral law, who would seek God's existence, who are we to say that we wouldn't have done it that way? Unless you want to insist upon an ultra-literal interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, you have a completely compatible view here that I hold that most scientists who are serious believers, and there are a lot of us, also hold as well.
Mike, thanks for your call. A few more minutes here with geneticist Francis Collins. And Francis, again, you'll be with us next Wednesday, November 14th, for a civil dialogue entitled The Intersection of Faith and Evolution. We'll be talking about questions such as, can science support religious views? Where do science and religion overlap? How is religion compatible with scientific thinking? A panel. It's down at WOSU at COSI at our studios next Wednesday, November 14th, 7:30 to 9 o'clock. The pre-registration is closed, but we have some additional seats in the atrium at WOSU at COSI, so just come prior to 7:30 next Wednesday, November 14th. Also, we will be linked here to the Fawcett Center in the auditorium, I believe, at 2400 Olentangy River Road, and to the Newark and Lima campuses. If you need more information, let me give you that phone number once again. It's in, of course, area 614, and the phone number for information, 228-2674. That's 228-2674. And a four-digit extension, 2541. That's 2541. And, of course, our dialogue is free and open to the public. And also on Wednesday, November 14th, Dr. Collins will be lecturing at 4 o'clock on campus here at 131 Hitchcock Hall. That's 131 Hitchcock Hall. That will be free and open to the public as well. Just a couple of more minutes, so callers will get to you if you are brief and concise. And here's Dina. Hi, Dina.
Hi. I was wondering if you have considered, given that you're a geneticist, that a pair of creators might be a likely source of all this wonder that we have around us?
You mean because of the pair of strands that make up the DNA double helix?
Well, that, and you have so much of nature where it requires that pairing to perpetuate things, even in plants.
Well, I see sort of where you're coming from, and of course in nature that is often the case, although not universally so. But I think of God as outside of nature, and therefore I'm not quite sure how to apply natural explanations or principles to God's existence. And I guess at the bottom of it, I'm a monotheist in a pretty strong way, the idea of going away from a single almighty presence into something that involves even two gods seems very inconsistent with all the centuries of careful examination of those options.
Dina, thanks for your call today. Final caller here very quickly is Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Fred. Boy, I find this very interesting.
Got to be quick now.
I was wondering if you would have your guest back for a more balanced hour and possibly have him on in a debate with someone like Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens.
Well, we'll talk about that, but do you have a question?
Yes, there's two problems that I don't think your guest can offer an explanation for. The number one is the idea of an infinite regression. If indeed there is a creator, then who created the creator?
Okay, and we just have time to talk about that one because we're almost out of time. Francis.
So I think that applies only if you limit yourself solely to the natural world. I don't see that the infinite regress argument holds much weight if you say that God is outside of nature, because in that case, God may not require a creator at all. It basically takes the argument into a different place. If you want to read more about these arguments related to this and other issues, I did debate Richard Dawkins, and that's published in Time magazine about a year ago and still up on the web, so I'd encourage you to go have a look at that.
Francis Collins is with us, and thank you, caller. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody today. Francis, we'll see you next Wednesday, November 14th at 7:30 at WOSU at COSI Studios, and maybe some of our listeners will be there as well.
That'd be great. See you next week, Fred.
Thanks so much for being with us. News is next at WOSU 820 AM Columbus, on the web at WOSU.org.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on WOSU comes from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher education faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at ohea.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.